what is happening with the phasing out of many of the moratoriums is that you have to show that your continuing ability to pay or your past ability to pay was COVID-related. So you put another administrative burden on an ordinary person who's already in a very adverse situation.
Today on Law Next, a conversation with sociologist Rebecca Sandifer, who is one of the leading experts, if not the leading expert, on access to justice in the United States and even globally. Rebecca is a professor at Arizona State University, faculty fellow at the American Bar Foundation, where she founded and leads the Access to Justice Research Initiative, and a visiting scholar at the Russell Sage Foundation. She's a 2018 recipient of a MacArthur Genius Fellowship for her work in promoting a new evidence-based approach to increasing access to civil justice for low-income communities. This is Bob Ambrogi, and you're listening to Law Next, the podcast that features the innovators and entrepreneurs who are driving what's next in law. We'll get to today's interview in just a moment, but first, let's hear from the sponsors who generously support Law Next. And now, on to this week's interview. Rebecca Sandifer, welcome to Law Next.
Thank you so much. It's great to be with you.
I think you're my first certifiable genius that I've had on the show. I've had some really smart people, but you're the first one who has credentials to prove it.
So. Well, you'll learn about how much that matters.
No, it's very impressive, obviously, and congratulations to you on that honor.
Thank you.
Yeah.
It was great to have access to justice recognized as something that was worthy of attention. So that's the best thing about it.
Yeah, that's true. And given that we are in unusual times, let me just ask how you're doing and how you're holding up during all of this.
We're very fortunate. We're employed and we've been very healthy. And so I think we're doing about as well as anybody can right now. So how about you?
Pretty much the same, yeah. It's actually been a surprisingly busy time for me, but I'm healthy and I got a paycheck coming in, so it's all good. There's an awful lot I want to talk to you about today, but I'm just curious to start how it was that you started down this path of exploring civil justice, both here in the United States, and I know you were working on issues globally as well, but how did you start down this path?
The big trigger was an accident. So I was
like
in graduate
so many.
School. Like so many things that shape our lives.
Yeah.
I was in graduate school and in sociology at the University of Chicago, and I needed to write a dissertation. And my original dissertation plan fell through, and someone happened to call me and say, I have this project on the careers of lawyers and how they've changed between the 50s and today. At that point, it was the mid-90s. And I need a research assistant. And I thought, okay, well, here's some data, and I can write a dissertation. And so I wrote my dissertation about inequality in the careers of lawyers and how that had changed over time, because I had gone to graduate school to study inequality specifically. And then as I finished that up and moved on to thinking about why we would care about inequality in the legal profession and what lawyers do, I began to think about their really interesting role in legal systems like ours. So you have a public justice system where we elect people to write laws, and then we pay taxes to build courthouses and staff them and give them clerks and file folders and IT systems and all that stuff. But we've made that system so complicated, or at least allowed it to get so complicated, that you really need to go to a private third party and pay that person, that would be a lawyer usually, to use your own legal system. And so I thought that was really interesting. We don't do that with public school, for example. If you live in a community that has a public school and you have a school-aged child, you can enroll your child in that school. You don't have to hire an educational consultant who goes to every meeting with the principal and so on. And so I began to think about how that might shape people's ability to access their own laws and the rights they have under them. And that's what sent me down this path.
And let me just step back for a second, because when you talk about inequality in the careers of lawyers, are you talking about inequality and opportunity for, say, people of color or for women? Or what were you talking about?
So my dissertation actually was looking at, so those kinds of traits are playing out across some structure that's shaped by those traits, right? Shaped by the entry of women, for example. But it's also shaped by other forces like shifts in what clients want and the base of the economy. And so one of the very first questions I asked was, in the mid-90s, everybody was convinced that if you joined law in the 50s, everybody became partner and they had these wonderful lives and it was a golden age. No one ever got sick. Everyone always had plenty of food. You know, it was apparently a great time to be a lawyer in the 50s.
Right.
And then by the 90s, it was impossible to become partner and this was terrible and partners were zinging around like electrons. And what you saw is that about, if you think of this sort of golden age career, which is people start in one law firm and then they get partnered there and then they finish there, that was about 16% of the careers of private practice Chicago lawyers in the 50s, 60s, 70s. And by the 90s, it was about 8%. So yes, it was much less likely than it used to be, but it was never very likely, right? So it's sort of this kind of story that we tell that's kind of ill-informed nostalgia about the past that helps us understand why now is so hard. That was the main finding of that of that project.
So I can tell you I have a very short list of people I've wanted to have on the show, and you've been on that short list. But what prompted me to reach out to you in particular this week was news out of Washington State that the Supreme Court there had voted to end the limited license legal technician program, which was, you know, the first of its kind, at least structured as an LLLT program that actually licensed people who hadn't gone through law school to provide legal services on a limited basis without the supervision of a lawyer. And I know that you had prepared a preliminary evaluation of that program a couple of years ago. You and Thomas Clark at the National Center for State Courts had looked at how that program was working. So I wondered if we could just kind of start with there and ask you, back in 2017, when you looked at that, what was your assessment? How did it seem to be working?
Well, so we were interested in three things. So one was whether this could ever work. So what's the sort of face validity, you would call it, in a social science research project? Given the way that it's set up, could this actually function? We were interested in its efficacy. So would people use it? If they used it, would it provide effective and safe services? And then we were interested in its sustainability and the capacity that idea might have to scale. And so our sense, this was very early, of course, in its lifespan, but our sense was that certainly this was a plausible idea. It was the first time anyone in a U.S. jurisdiction had tried to do something like this, a truly independent practitioner with a limited law license. So it could work. Certainly, clients that we spoke with felt like they received good services that they were grateful for, that they were happy to use. And there were really entrepreneurial individuals in those early classes of LLLTs who were thinking about ways to scale their practices using market-based remote services that unbundle both things to the consumer, the way a lawyer might unbundle part of a problem to the consumer, but also unbundle the things that LLLTs couldn't do to fully qualified lawyers. So LLLTs could never appear in court. So they would often spin off the core litigation part of somebody's problem to a fully qualified lawyer. And so it seemed like a model that could work. When that decision came out of the Washington Supreme Court last week, it was disappointing for sure. And I think it was the wrong decision, but that doesn't prevent them from making right decisions in the future. And it also doesn't hold back from the fact that actually around the country, these efforts have a lot of energy behind them and are underway on the ground in the West, but also under consideration in the Midwest and the East.
Well, even in Arizona, where you are, right, there have been programs that have, I don't know if they've emulated the LLLT program, but similar in structure.
Yeah. And in Utah has a licensed paralegal practitioner.
Right.
And, you know, while Washington has decided to scale this back, Utah is exploring expanding the practice areas for their LPPs, they call them. So
right.
I think.
Right. Who was the, you talk about the consumers served by this program. What kinds of consumers did it serve? What kinds of consumers did the LLLT licensed practitioners serve?
So LLLTs were licensed to practice a big chunk of family law, so divorce, parenting plans, things like that. There were things they couldn't do. They couldn't or wouldn't, at least when you talk to them. They didn't want to do things around pensions. Pensions can be very complicated when people separate. But so lots of the core work of divorce. They could give you legal advice. Because they had a limited law license, they had lawyer-client privilege with you. They could prepare documents for you. They could file them. It was a little tricky to work that out, but they could file them. The one thing that they couldn't do was negotiate with the other side or argue on your behalf to some kind of judge or other hearing officer. And so they served people who were middle-income clients or lower-middle-income clients, because it was a market-based service, who were trying to get divorced, and trying to manage those processes can be very complicated and certainly are very obscure if you haven't done it before. So, and people, as I say, seemed grateful for what they had to offer. When consumers had challenges. They had two different challenges. So one is it's a new thing. And I think this will be an issue that comes up with these other programs around the country. It's a new kind of provider. How do you help consumers discover it, and how do you help them understand its limitations? So the triple LTs that Tom Clark and I talked to were really good about explaining to their, or at least they described themselves as being very good about explaining to their clients what they can do and what they can't do, and when you would need a lawyer to do certain kinds of things. But sort of just understanding what's the difference between a lawyer and one of these things, I think is challenging for consumers. And knowing that they're there at all, because everybody knows about lawyers, even though they may not know what they do or when you would go to one. But these innovations of all kinds are sometimes challenging for consumers to discover.
And I guess it was challenging for the bar structure in Washington as well. I mean, their argument was, I guess, essentially a cost-benefit one, where they were arguing that they were spending a lot of money to maintain this program, and that it, you know, in terms of its impact on, say, access to justice in Washington, the impact was pretty small overall. I think there were only roughly 40 or so people who were ever licensed as triple LTs. Only some of them were actually practicing on their own. Others were in firms or other settings. So how do you evaluate, you know, whether something like that is worth the cost of maintaining and pursuing?
Well, I think I wasn't privy to the deliberations.
Yeah, I don't mean you personally, but
the court made. But I think if I were talking with the court, I would say, you know, there's another value here besides the line on your budget about the regulatory costs of this program, which were quite high relative to its size. And that's creating avenues for people who currently have absolutely no ability to use the laws that we've made to order these very important parts of life, to give them some ability to access justice in that way. And that's also a value, and it might be worth spending a lot of money on, or at least thinking about why this regulatory structure was so expensive and how you might make it cheaper. The triple LTs were heavily regulated. I mean, they had to buy malpractice insurance, right? And lawyers in Washington don't. Lawyers in most states don't. And so thinking about maybe there are less expensive and intrusive ways to create the same kinds of consumer protections, I think is very important going forward for these efforts. The triple LT model is very top down. So the bar designed the new role in working with the state and said, this is the innovative thing you can do. There are other states that are creating regulatory experimental spaces where then you have providers who could be, you know, for-profit entrepreneurs of different kinds, or they could be nonprofits who want to expand the service profile that their current staff have. Those folks propose to come in and offer services either for free or in a market system. So that there's, and then the regulation is tighter than it is on lawyers in some way, but lighter, because it's not all about certification.
Right.
It's about empirically assessing risk and harm.
Right. The rules are different.
Yeah.
Or, yeah. And so you're primarily talking about Utah, I guess, when you're talking about that. Or are there other states that are kind of experimenting? I mean, I know California has, you know, is still talking about it, but Utah is really putting rubber to the road, I guess, as they say.
Yeah, Utah is the first mover. Arizona is doing some of it. Arizona is getting rid of Rule 5.4, which is non-lawyer ownership, and creating one of these certificated roles. And then California, I used to live in California and was involved in some of this stuff back then. It always kind of runs up to the edge and then hesitates. But I think right now they're looking very seriously at the Utah model. So that's very encouraging.
Yeah. Rebecca, we hear so much about this access to justice problem in our country and elsewhere. And I see various numbers thrown around that are used to describe the breadth of the justice gap. Based on your research, based on what you've seen, how do you quantify the justice gap in the United States? And what do you really mean by access to justice when you're talking about it?
Well, so since you asked me, I'm going to tell you what I mean.
Well, that's who I'm asking.
Which is different, I think, often than what people working in this space have meant in the past. So in the past, often when people talked about access to justice, what they were thinking of was access to a service from somebody who had some kind of legal expertise to help you resolve a problem that has already been identified as legal.
AKA a lawyer.
Right. And what I would say access to justice is let's step back from where the service comes from and think about what social good it is that we want to achieve. And the social good is that we've decided through our processes of making these kinds of decisions that there's some parts of life activity that are so important to the individuals who experience them and the communities that they live in that we need them to be ordered in an authoritative way that's common across everybody. And so when your problem or my problem is resolved in a way that's consistent with what that authoritative norm says, that's access to justice. So to give you an example, one problem that's endemic in the United States is wage theft. So people work and they don't get paid overtime, or they don't get paid for all the hours that they work. And of course, they're supposed to be paid for all the hours that they work. And that's actually a violation of the law. But whether you resolve that problem by going to your employer and saying, listen, I want my overtime, or writing your own really good complaint letter to the wage and hour authority in your state, or hiring a lawyer, or filing a lawsuit, those are all different routes to that same goal. And so part of the efforts around access to justice that you see in the United States and globally now are thinking about how to widen that set of possible routes to that just resolution, a substantively and also normatively just resolution to those kinds of very common problems. So that's what I would say access to justice is. That's actually kind of hard to quantify because you need to compare everybody's experience to what the law would say.
Right,
but we know things like pre-COVID, because COVID will have increased this massively, Americans experienced between 100 and 150 million new civil justice problems every year. So around employment, around housing, around family issues, around benefits, environmental problems. And COVID has only increased that. So there are, I haven't looked at the most recent unemployment claim numbers, but it's something on the order of 40 million new unemployment claims, which also means that 40 million new people lost their main source of income, which means that they are at peril of not paying all kinds of obligations that they've contractually agreed to fulfill related to their housing, related to their car, which lets them go to look for new jobs and so on. And so there'll be a lot of additional justice problems created by that impact of the pandemic. But then also, you know, there have been an enormous number of deaths, and those are tragic for the people and families who experience them, but they also create their own set of civil justice problems around probate and heir property and advance directives and those kinds of things. And so there's just this enormous amount of that out there. And what we know from the best research we have in the U.S. is that in the U.S., as well as most places in the world, the vast majority of those kinds of problems never become lawsuits and go to court or hearing officers of different kinds, and they never receive any attention from an attorney. So in the U.S., maybe 11% of justice problems become court cases, and maybe 24% ever touch a lawyer, and that might be the lawyer saying, you got nothing going on here.
Right.
And if you look at what makes it to law, it's things that people understand to be legal already. So everybody, you can't get divorced without going through law. So people know that that's a legal problem. The personal injury bar has been very successful in identifying certain kinds of problems as that, you know, your illness or your injury as legal problems. But for the most part, people have all of these issues in their lives that are governed by the law, but they don't recognize their legal aspects. And so they don't seek legal expertise to assist them in understanding and acting on them. And that's the justice. In that is the justice gap. Now, some of those people will resolve their problems just fine, but, you know, we certainly hear spectacular stories about people who don't.
Yeah. But so if these justice problems are problems that people often resolve on their own, or maybe with help from a family member or something like that, how is that a problem of access to justice?
Well, if we go back to that idea that access to justice is the correct substantive resolution of your problem. So there's some set of bounds that the law says this should be resolved in. Did your problem get resolved in those bounds? If I talk to my neighbor and he says, listen, you know, bosses are all just jerks and there's no point in pursuing this unpaid wage claim. Okay, so I've chosen, quote unquote, not to pursue my claim. But we as a society want people to collect those wages so they can participate in the economy and take care of themselves and their families and pay taxes and so on. And so that's where even the informal help can create still an unresolved justice problem, even though you might be very content with the way it, or at least resigned to the way that it resolved.
So is there anything wrong? I mean, are there places where people need lawyers that they aren't getting them? You know, do people actually fare better when they have lawyers in certain circumstances? Do we even know that? Have we studied that? Or is it just a matter of, in some cases, people tend to go to lawyers, and in some cases, people tend to resolve these things on their own?
I am so glad you asked that question. So a few years ago, I was trying to answer this question, which seemed to me like a perfectly straightforward question. Does it matter if you're involved in a court case, whether or not you have a lawyer to represent you or not? And I thought, of course, my guess was, of course it does. Of course you're better off with a lawyer. Of course, someone will have shown this. And what you see if you look over 40 or 50 years of research is there are, you know, dozens of studies that people have done of the impact of having fully qualified lawyers on case outcomes. And they vary enormously in what they find. So sometimes lawyers reduce your chance of winning. Sometimes they increase it, but they look a lot like non-lawyers. So already in the United States, without any regulatory changes in a range of state tax courts and different kinds of tribunals, immigration courts, lots of federal tribunals, people who are not lawyers but are certified representatives in that particular forum can represent you. And there are many instances where they do as well or sometimes better than fully qualified attorneys. What I found looking across a range of studies, and it's also consistent with research that's coming out of the UK and in other US jurisdictions, is that non-lawyers can do as well or often better than lawyers when the legal issues are simpler. But once complex issues of law are raised, then you really do need, 3 years of law school and passing the bar and understanding things about how to make those more sophisticated kinds of arguments. So there's a space where absolutely people need lawyers for us as a society to achieve just resolution. But there's a big space where what they need is somebody with some kinds of expertise, but not as expansive as what it requires to get a JD.
Right. I remember hearing Jim Greiner at Harvard talk a couple of years ago about a study that he did of people going to housing court and looking at some who went to housing court on their own and some who went to housing court with the help of a lawyer for the day, and which set fared better. And I may be totally mangling what he reported, but as I recall, the outcome was that those who went entirely without the help of a lawyer actually ended up faring better overall than those who had that lawyer for a day assistance.
I am not going to copy that finding.
Yeah, I may be totally mangling that, but I
it's on his SSRN page. I know. No, I've read that study, but I can't remember that precise fact about it.
Yeah, it's interesting. But, it does interest me, though, that you were able to go back and look at various studies, because it seems like there aren't all that many empirical studies in law of what does work or doesn't work in terms of delivering legal services or serving legal needs. Am I wrong about that?
No, I think that's true. And if you look at who's done them, it's been, so advocacy organizations will do it, but they'll go observe in a court and collect cases and things like that. Clinical law professors often will study their own practices. So we have some great, actually peer-reviewed studies out of clinical practice. But it kind of reflects, I mean this in the nicest way, lawyers and legal scholars care a lot about law as that thing that's in all those books and gets argued about by people in appellate courts. And most of the justice problems of ordinary people are not that. And so there's just not, it's not the prestigious, cool, exciting thing for particularly legal scholars to study. They tend to study the law itself and how it develops through case law.
We'll get back to my interview in just a moment. But first, let's take a break to hear from the sponsors who generously support Law Next. And now, let's continue this week's interview. Let me go back for a second just to that scope of the problem question, because I often hear numbers around 80, 87%, something. I think the legal services study a couple of years ago that I think you were involved in some way put it at 87% of individuals are unable to access legal services when they have a legal problem. Are those numbers founded on any firmament, or where did they come from? I mean, is it possible to at all really describe the breadth of this issue?
I think so. That's the project that came out of the National Opinion Research Center, but it was on behalf of the Legal Services Corporation. Okay. So that was a really good justice gap study for the legal aid eligible population of the United States. 87% seems totally plausible to me, because two things happen. One is, if you are eligible for legal aid in the U.S., those organizations turn away at least as many people as they serve because of lack of resources to serve them. So that's the first barrier. But both low-income people, moderate-income people, and high-income people are very unlikely to think of their civil justice problems as having legal aspects. And so they're unlikely to seek legal assistance with those problems. So it's a twofold thing. You don't go, many people just don't go. They don't seek that kind of help. And then when they get there, they're very often turned away. If you look at how people think about their justice problems from surveys that I've done, they tend to think that they are bad luck. The most common way Americans describe them is as either bad luck or God's will for me. So as things that either just happened to me or that are supposed to happen to me. And of course, if this is what just happens, then the way I understand my solution set is very different than if I think it's somebody else's fault or there's a big legal regime that governs the way it should go down.
Right. So much of the news in recent weeks has been consumed with issues of racial injustice in this country. What have you learned in your research about how race and class relate to access to justice?
I think one of the really interesting backstories to what we've seen over the past few years around Black Lives Matter and other movements that to bring attention to police brutality is that often those interactions with the police are initiated by civil problems. So you have a bench warrant out for you because you failed to appear for some kind of hearing around debt, or you have a bench warrant out for you because you failed to pay child support. And that then becomes, I mean, there are literally people who have been shot by the police in the last few years for the crime of not paying child support, essentially. And so thinking about those sort of prior problems that are creating some of the interactions with the police and how to solve those in a better way is a very important part of racial justice. Another thing to think about when you're thinking about how to reach out to different communities, it's not clear that everybody makes these big distinctions between different parts of the justice system. So depending on your experiences and the folks you're talking to and their experiences, you may not be particularly confident that your interactions with the justice system, broadly viewed, will be of benefit to you, because your own interactions with the criminal justice system or your interactions with the police have not been very positive. It's clear that if you want to think of the criminal as two parts of the justice system, it's clear that people's experiences in them are very tightly interlinked, and that resolving problems on one side is going to require some resolution of the problems on the other side as well.
So those kinds of issues really fall very squarely within your discussion, your definition, I guess, of justice problems, as opposed to legal needs, as we might otherwise think of them.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Here's a big question for you. What do we do about the access to justice problem in this country? How do we begin to tackle it? What are some of the ways that we can begin to close that justice gap?
So I think if you look at the way that we've approached this traditionally, we've felt like justice is the province of lawyers and judges. And so we need to expand the participation of lawyers and judges in providing access to justice. And so we want judges to be nicer, more approachable, and then we want more lawyers or more lawyers' time. And so we ask lawyers to do more pro bono work, and then we try to get more funding for fully subsidized legal services. And I think those are both valuable things to ask of the profession and valuable things to work towards. But it's clear that after trying this for, let's say we've been trying it for 60 years in the US, but I think longer than that, it doesn't work, right? We're unable or unwilling to fill the justice gap using those traditional methods. So then let's do something that's more foundational and think about how we can open up a space so that different kinds of providers can move in and assist people with these justice problems and be able to interface. And that people without legal experience can interface successfully with their own courts. So how simple can we make these processes and still achieve justice? Do they really need to be as complicated as they are? I think we see efforts around the country that show that they're not. There are lots of people with knowledge and expertise and computer programs with knowledge and expertise that can be providing assistance to people who have different kinds of justice problems, either as individuals or as members of communities. And right now, the current UPL laws prevent those people and movements from doing all that they could do. And so reimagining the way to regulate this space, I think, is essential if this is what we really want to do.
So if re-regulation is essential, are you satisfied with some of the directions in which regulatory reform seems to be headed right now? I mean, you mentioned UPL laws, and there's some efforts to broaden those laws or maybe loosen those laws so that more people can provide legal services. There's efforts around ownership of law firms and investment in law firms. Is that the right way to be headed with this?
I think in a context like the United States, which I would call a sort of democratic capitalist society,
sort of,
that's markets are the place that we use to distribute most things. And so innovations or changes that allow more things to be distributed in legal services markets are a good way to go. I think it will be interesting to see. As somebody who thinks about it from the consumer side, I think one of the great things about Utah is its focus on risk and consumer protection. Although in the United Kingdom, there are no legal advice, at least it's not a restricted activity. So there have been non-lawyer advice providers for many years, and some of them are fantastic. But sort of thinking about consumer protection is one important thing. I will be really interested to see how the relaxation on non-lawyer ownership affects legal services for ordinary people. Certainly in Utah, you're seeing, so I'm on the implementation task force for Utah's reforms. You're seeing new models of legal services provision for ordinary people being proposed that involve non-lawyer ownership. So, you know, the tech developer is going to be compensated by owning part of the profits of the new entity. Whether that becomes the dominant model or whether it's, I mean, if I were a big law firm, I would be all over this. Thinking about ways to, you know, design very lucrative services that wrap around the needs of my corporate clients.
Right.
We haven't seen that yet, but you certainly could imagine it. And so it'd be interesting to see, like, once that becomes possible, where does that money go?
Yeah.
Go to services for people, or does it go to services for businesses?
Yeah. It seems in part like those kinds of reforms are all targeted at the access to legal help part of the equation. But, you know, as you've described it, there's another side to it, which is figuring out what kind of help people need for those kinds of justice problems that aren't ever going to go to a lawyer or a legal services provider or whatever else. So does regulatory reform get at that at all? You know, your example you gave previously of the overtime case or somebody having maybe a tenant dispute that's not ever going to end up in court or something. How do we get at addressing those problems and getting people in those situations the help that they need?
One of the things you see with effective assistance is that it's timely, it's targeted, and it comes through a trusted source. So it shows up when you realize that you're in trouble. It's targeted to the specific problem that you understand yourself as having. So I'm not getting paid. And then it comes from someone who, or through some route that you already trust, so that you're willing to accept what this person or service has to offer you. And there's some really interesting models around the country that, again, can't go across the line of legal advice, but they build around existing organizations and relationships and communities. So one of my favorites is a program out of New York City that started as a way to write a really nice complaint letter to your landlord about a conditions violation, like no heat or no hot water or something like that. It's called Just Fix. And they built out from that by working with coalitions that were already there in New York City, a way of identifying landlords who have many such complaints, because you have access to those kinds of data through open data laws in New York City. They've developed ways, and that dashboard of information about landlords, I think it's called the worst landlords in New York or something like that. That dashboard of information is a tool for tenant organizers, for legal aid lawyers that want to think about how to do litigation that will have a bigger bang for its buck, I guess. And they've moved on to thinking about, so as part of responses to COVID-19, many states and communities implemented eviction moratoria. So the first thing is, not all landlords know there's an eviction moratoria. And so they, you know, tell tenants they're going to evict them anyways. So tenants need some support in communicating with their landlords in an authoritative way. And so Just Fix has developed some ways to do that. And then what is happening with the phasing out of many of the moratoriums is that you have to show that your continuing ability to pay or your past ability to pay was COVID related. So you put another administrative burden on an ordinary person who's already in a very adverse situation. And so Just Fix is working with, again, on the ground grassroots groups to think about how to develop a tool that lets the tenant write that letter and connect them with that tool. So those are the kinds of things that you could, so imagine what a program like that could do if it could give just a tiny bit of legal advice, or if those tenant organizers could give just a tiny bit of legal advice, or if the labor of the people who are doing the wage justice work could give just a tiny bit of legal advice. I mean, I think that's a really important part of expanding not just access to justice as perceived from the legal system, but of growing the capacities of communities to recognize the problems that they confront and to organize around solving them.
So is it fair to say, based on that example, that you see technology as a critical component of enhancing access to justice?
I mean, one of the things about lawyers is they're so hard to scale because they're so bespoke in retail. And there are parts of what lawyers do that are actually quite routine and could be automated and made more efficient and consistent and less error prone. And so if you think about that as something that can happen with a lot of the pieces of legal issues that people have, I think it's a really important tool in expanding that.
What are you currently working on? What's got your focus and attention these days?
So I just finished a paper that will come out. Thanks for asking. It will come out in the Stanford Journal of Civil Rights and Civil Liberties that reviews research around the world on the effectiveness and accessibility of non-lawyer sources of legal services. And it shows that people use them and they can be really effective. And I'm also finishing up a project on legal technologies, focusing on consumer-facing legal technologies.
Okay. And by the effectiveness of non-lawyer providers of legal services, are you talking about providers such as the LLLTs in Washington?
The best research actually comes out of the United Kingdom, where they do peer review of work product. And they compare the quality, as assessed by an expert in each area of law, of the wills, for example, that are produced by solicitors who are office lawyers in the UK versus specialized will writers. And that research shows that often the non-lawyers outperform the non-lawyer specialists. This is a fairly consistent finding, outperform the lawyer generalists if you're looking at the quality of the work product.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. You mentioned earlier the fact that the pandemic is going to give rise to a potential flood of new types of legal woes for people or justice woes for people. But there's also been a lot of conjecture that one silver lining in all this is that at least in the legal profession, we are going to become more adept at using technology to deliver legal services, that courts are going to become more adept at using technology to meet the needs of those who require court services. Do you buy that? Do you see positive reforms coming out of what we've been going through over these last couple of months?
Certainly in Utah, a lot of the applications that are coming into the regulatory space, the new regulatory space, are looking at remote services of different kinds, which are important when you can't go to the physical space because of a pandemic, but they're also important just because of mobility and distance issues. I think the thing that you've seen with courts, which is really interesting, is courts resisted things like e-filing because right. They're like, oh, we got to put in this big system, or we're only going to let lawyers do it, and they're going to have to fill the subscription, and we're going to have a private company do it. But then they had to manage their business in the absence of those things. And so, you know, courts have moved to allowing people essentially to file by email. And by that experience, courts have discovered that the world actually didn't come to an end.
Right.
Now, it does raise some issues, right? So if you're doing remote hearings and they're supposed to be public, but you're doing them by Skype for business, right. Are they getting recorded? Is there a public record of them? You know, I mean, these changes in the modality raise a bunch of really interesting issues about how to preserve the values of the old system within the technology of the new. But I think, yes, definitely, it's been a great push for people to see they can do this, they can do it really fast, and it works okay.
Yeah. At the same time, they resolve some of the issues that existed under the prior system. I mean, just access to courts. You know, if you can have virtual access to courts without having to hop on a cross-city bus or arrange a babysitter or whatever else, that could be a huge development for a lot of, especially lower-income people who are involved in the courts.
Absolutely. And if you can do it on your own time asynchronously, then you don't have to take time off work, etc.
Right.
And you're also perhaps in a place that's more comfortable for you, so that you feel more comfortable participating in the proceeding than if you're in a big, bustling, chaotic courthouse.
Yep. So going back to this, the justice gap, and I can let you go after this, but is there any promise of actually closing this gap or significantly reducing this gap? I mean, are you optimistic about our ability to address the justice gap?
I would say I'm hopeful about our ability to address the justice gap. I mean, there's some part of it that is, if you're going to have capitalism, you're going to have an enormous amount of inequality.
Right.
And so the thing you have to think about, if you're a democratic society where you want everyone to be able to participate in our common life, how are you going to manage the fact that inequality is there, and what forms of it are you not okay with? Like, are you not okay with only some people being able to be fairly treated by or to be able to use their own justice system? And so I think these developments hold a lot of promise to bridge that. Of course, if you're thinking about something like eviction, part of the cause of eviction is that housing in some places is so incredibly expensive, and no amount of amazing eviction law or eviction defense will solve that problem. So it won't fix everything, but I think that we can make some really serious progress in helping people be able to use their own laws and participate in their own justice system.
Is it important for legal professionals to think differently about the justice gap. I mean, I read something you wrote last year that was, I guess, critical of the use of the term unmet legal needs to talk about the justice gap, because it's limiting to use that phrase. But that does tend to be how lawyers think about it. Do we need to re-educate lawyers about what this means?
I think that would be great. And I think that re-education would be good not only for the justice gap, but it would be good for the legal profession. You know, when lawyers hear about some of these regulatory changes that might allow essentially more competition in terms of providers for legal services, they often feel very threatened. But it's also an opportunity for them to think about new ways to connect with potential clients. I mean, that gap is an enormous untapped market. And so if lawyers were to start to think about, how can I reach these people? What is the service that I can design at a price they can afford, that I can live with, that they really need to solve their problem? I think that would be good for the bar as well as for the rest of us.
All right. Well, Rebecca, I really appreciate your taking the time to speak with me. It's been a real pleasure.
Thank you so much for the opportunity.
And I hope you stay safe and well, and continue to follow the important work you do.
Thank you very much. You stay safe and well, too.
Thanks. That does it for today's show. Thanks to Populous Radio and Ben Ambrogi for producing and editing the show. That's it for this week. This is Bob Ambrogi.